it's kind of like driving stick shift versus an automatic transmission. I mean, an automatic transmission is easier, but you're not really driving, right? The car is driving you. So I want you to, close your eyes and take a deep breath and remember that feeling the first time you drove a stick.
I've never driven a stick shift.
Really?
I don't know how to drive stick.
No, no one taught you to drive stick?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't know how to drive stick?
No.
Your mom never taught you to drive
stick. What, are we caught in a loop? No, man.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 268 for the week of September 16th, 2019. I am Halloween Sidewalk Nap David T. Cole, and I'm here with Telltale Juice Box Sarah D. Bunting.
Time is a flat slurp.
Barkeeper's friend Tara Ariano.
Shots, cocks, shots, cocks.
And drunken wedding toaster Kevin O'Keefe.
I also never learned how to drive stick.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us this week is our friend Kevin O'Keefe. Welcome back, Kevin.
Yay, thank
Kevin.
You, Tara. Excited to be here.
Yay!
We are here to talk about the new animated half-hour series from Amazon, but it's not a comedy. It's a drama. Yes, even more so than BoJack Horseman, although it has some of the same creative people behind it in common. Undone is a rotoscoped animated series about a preschool teacher named Alma, who's voiced by Rosa Salazar from Alita Battle Angel. She, as we start the series, probably has depression. She talks about how bored she is of living. She wears the same outfit every day, although that might just be that she's a cartoon character. Hard to say. At the end of the first episode, she gets into a car crash. And then in the episode after that, what's revealed to her in the hospital is that her father, who died 20 years ago, is now visible to her, and he is going to take her on a journey to learn how to basically travel through time, more or less. And we will talk about the series as a whole, which is roughly eight half-hour episodes in season one. Let's start with a slightly more of a procedural question. I felt like the first two episodes should have been presented as a series premiere, since it's not until after Alma wakes up that we even understand like why the show would be animated, never mind that it's about more than a disaffected millennial. Kevin, did you feel that way?
Absolutely. I think that if you just edit them together in one and make it an hour-long pilot and then have it be a seven-episode series, I think you don't lose anything. And yeah, it's just strange to have the whole point of the show not exist in the first. The first episode's,
yes,
almost like a prologue, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, Sarah, it sounds like you felt that way, too.
I did. I mean, and I didn't get through the whole, I mean, that wasn't necessarily why. There were a number of reasons that I didn't end up watching to the end, which I may still do, but, and that wasn't my only issue with it either, but I did find it odd that the entire point of the series is so slow to arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all for atmospherics, and I think the performances are good here, but there's been enough press surrounding the show that I felt like this was a little self-indulgent of the show to not just get to it already. Because, mm-hmm, like, we know what the premise is, so why are you shilly-shallying around like getting to it? So,
yeah.
This isn't the first Amazon show, half-hour show, with that problem, though, because Forever had the exact same problem, where,
yeah,
it takes, yes, three episodes to get to its premise.
Yeah, that's a great point. I forgot about Forever, although so did Amazon, it seems like.
Oh, yeah.
But I felt like it was a little bit arrogant, just because it's a streaming show that drops all at once, just be like, well, people will check out the whole thing. And it's like,
yeah,
people watch pilots and then they stop. Like, if they don't grab you, that's on you.
Like, do we remember that Amazon's whole thing once was like the pilot process for,
right,
their streaming shows? They've just abandoned that entirely. Undone, yeah, would have never made it past that process.
Probably not in,
well,
this form,
I think,
anyway.
We actually covered it when they first started doing it, and the show that we, Tara and I, liked the least was the one that lasted for like 5 years somehow.
Oh God, yeah.
It's like, wait, Mozart in the Jungle lived? Okay.
Yeah.
And won like a lot of Globes.
Yeah, it did. I was going to say. Yeah. So going on to get into the meat of the quest of the show. So even though references to severe mental illness in Alma's paternal grandmother, Geraldine, are peppered throughout the series, for me, it wasn't until the season was almost over that it occurred to me that the work that Alma is doing with Jacob, her father, who's voiced by Bob Odenkirk, that this work actually isn't real and might be attributed to the onset of schizophrenia in her, even though it is very clearly established that she's been prescribed antipsychotic meds that she isn't taking. So, Kevin, let's start with you. What was your feeling about the possible interpretations of what Alma is going through? And in other words, did the storytelling earn your trust, or am I just a really easy mark that fell for it?
I think neither is true. I don't think you're an easy mark, because I think the story actually is it. Told well enough to make you disbelieve that. But I don't know. I just knowing that Raphael Bob Wasberg, the creator of BoJack Horseman, was heavily involved with this, just immediately made me think that it was primarily about something related to mental illness, because that's very much BoJack's whole joie de vivre now. You know, like it's the...
yes.
Anomie de vivre. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's. I think that was sort of the first flag for me, right? Where the idea of him being part of a show where it's very heavily mystical, it's very heavily connected to time travel and psychic power and all of that, like, that seemed less likely to me than just, oh, she's depressed, possibly schizophrenic, you know? Well,
there's a point about halfway through the season run where I believe it's the father. I mean, I guess this is spoiler territory. I guess you haven't figured it out now. We're just jumping around, much like the series is. We'll just jump around and talk about this and that. But there's a point right in the middle of the first season where the father says, like, schizophrenia actually might be the basis for, you know, shamanistic things in the past, where people that today we call schizophrenic, yesterday, were considered people that have a foot in both worlds. And like, is this show saying that she has schizophrenia and this is just the manifestation of it? Or is she saying that we misunderstand, you know, that schizophrenia is what we are calling in this show universe, the ability to go through more than we can see with our naked eye. I think everybody can be right, you know, but it doesn't say anything definitively. And which brings me to sort of like my major point with this show, which to read the synopsis of this show and to read the press, I think you'd be forgiven to think that this is another one of our recent mystery box shows. And it's not.
Yeah.
Like, it's a compelling mix of the personal and science fiction, but it doesn't really, like, the mechanics of the universe are there to service Alma, who's the main character's, you know, journey, what's going on with her. And it's not like there is a mystery a la Westworld or like Battlestar Galactica or something like that at the central of it. Like, I thought it was pretty clear, like, to me personally, it was pretty clear that the accident was going to be initiated by the father well before the episode we've seen it. We don't know the why of that yet. So for me, it's intriguing, but it's not like a mystery box show where I'm trying to guess which one is the Cylon, which I appreciate because I am so sick of that kind of show right now. Like, it's such an internet age. Like when we look back at the 2010s, you know, much like we can look back on the 90s or, you know, whatever today, like, that's going to be one of the markers. It's going to be like this generation of shows that was just like spot the five differences, the TV show. And I don't think this is that, which I appreciate.
Yeah. I think the show is actually kind of critical of that type of show in that regard. Like, at several different points, Alma's father is like pressing her to go ahead and solve the mystery. And she, there's conflicts with her boyfriend, Sam, that she's like, this is more important to me in this moment. Like, she pushes back against having to be focused on the mystery at all times. And those were actually the moments where I liked the show the most. I think I really liked the show, actually. I have some quibbles with it. But I think that it was critical enough of itself and its genre, quote unquote, that it still hooked me despite maybe falling into some more expected tropes, would be the way I would put it.
What were the tropes that you felt were expected that it fell into?
I guess, again, so connected to the fact that it's Raphael Bob Oxberg, like the mental health focus of it all, almost doggedly from the mother's perspective, was something that, like, I knew every time we saw that mother character, she would be talking about taking her medication, you know? Like, yeah. I knew that we would get that nagging mother character at all times. I knew in the first episode we see Alma's sister, who is set to be wed by Sirius's end, cheat with a bartender. I knew that would be, you know, the sort of, like, guilt over that would come back up over and over again, and indeed it did. Right. We literally see the bartender more than some main characters just to sort of appear and guilt the sister into feeling bad. Because also, well,
and also, if I may just interject, when we hear that the sister's fiance's name is Reed Hollingsworth, is like, oh, he's going to get cheated on.
Yep.
Such a cucky name.
Yep. Yeah, so there's stuff like that that I just felt like the series was a little too reliant on, but I think a lot of it was, I thought the writing was strong. Like, I thought that the dialogue itself was really enjoyable, better than I hear in a lot of animated series. And so I wonder how much I credit that to the show being a drama, that it doesn't have to sort of like do the setup punchline thing.
Well, also, yeah. I think it helps that everybody in the show, even though it ends up as an animated show, they're acting all these scenes out, right?
Yes.
So I think there's a big difference in their approach between standing in front of a microphone and actually being with other people and bouncing off them.
Totally. And that was the other thing I was going to say, is I thought the performances, especially Rosa Salazar's, were really good.
Agree. But I did have some issues with just sort of relationship realism.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a sister, but I do have a younger sibling, and I, you know, am close enough with him that it's sort of my template. And I just was not necessarily buying that this is how they were speaking to each other, like that they go to a bar to make this announcement, and then the sister is sort of like showing the ring very performatively and waiting for Alma to notice. And I was like, this doesn't feel real to me. This doesn't feel siblingy to me.
Mm-hmm.
Given that it, you know, in theory, I think they are supposed to be close, even though there is some push pull there. I also didn't buy that she was having these, you know, I don't want to settle down conversations, like, repeatedly and seemingly like only because the camera is there kind of conversations. And those little things took me out of it a little. The performances almost sold it for me, but there was a little bit of, and this goes back to the question of the pacing, I think, that it just didn't quite catch me. I mean, I think that once the premise has sort of been locked in, then the rest of the episodes are probably interesting and good. And it's not like I don't like BoJack, but I just kind of felt like arrogant was exactly the right word, that I kind of felt like I was being made to wait and sit through certain things that were not credible from an emotional standpoint, because I could be made to. And I was like, actually, no, there's other stuff on, and I will get back to this. Maybe spoiler, I might not.
It was also weird to me that that Becca is the younger sister, because she has so much older sister energy.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Also because the actor who plays her is older than Rosa Salazar too. It's Angelique Cabral, who is great. I agree. The performances are really great. It's well cast all around, I thought. Jean Triplehorn is the fiance's tight assy, possibly like mildly racist mother.
More than like, mildly, I would say.
And then okay, Chris fine, in the yes, morning right. is the future father-in-law. Like, what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do want to say one thing, since we brought up race. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that the show is set in San Antonio.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, because I have a question for you about that. Go ahead.
So that is my home. That is my literal hometown. Like, I was raised in Austin, but I was born and spent the first several years of my life in San Antonio. I would go back constantly. I have a very strong connection to the city. Mm-hmm. I don't think the depiction of San Antonio here makes a lick of sense. And I almost wonder why they even chose to set it in San Antonio, other than having a shot of the Alamo and the fact that that occasionally Alma talks about indigenous issues, which, like, fair. But it's really the San Antonio is a city that's pretty full of life, and very specifically Latinx Mexican life. Mm-hmm. And this depiction of it felt very low key, very, downright sort of like maudlin, you know? And I think that's sort of just the tone of the series. But I think it almost would have been more effective if we're going to make San Antonio the setting. I think it almost would have been more effective to have this, have everything around Alma be so lively and up, where her depression was all the more exaggerated against that backdrop, you know? Like, that feels like a good way to use this setting, especially because all of the sort of liveliness that I'm talking about always does have a very specific Mexican Latinx flair, and she herself being half Latinx just feels like, I don't know, just felt like a lot of missed opportunities on the location.
Interesting.
What was your question going to be?
Oh, I was going to ask you, because she has that rant about the Alamo, whether it was true to your experience of how the Alamo is taught to kids in school.
Yes. 1,000%. And that's partially just like Texas history is taught kind of racist. Like,
sure.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I did not really understand the story of the Alamo until I was like in later high school, because you just accept what's being taught to you when you're, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old.
Right. Wow. It's crazy that they start that early. Although I guess it's a good cowboy story.
You take Texas history. I don't know if it's like this with other states. You take Texas history like 4 different times in like young elementary school, older elementary school, middle school, high school.
Wow.
Yeah. Jersey was never a republic, so we didn't have to do that. I thank God.
Yeah. But it's, yeah, it's a lot.
I did like that that our intro to time travel is the desire to fix tiny faux pas. I thought that was a very relatable way to get into the story before it's established that the big mystery, the big purpose that Alma is supposed to have this power to solve is obviously the mystery of why her father died and whether she can go back and prevent him from getting killed. But the early loop that Alma gets caught in, where she's just like trying to choose your own adventure, how to get through a conversation with her mother without making things worse, was, I thought, a really nice touch. And, you know, sometimes is a motif of time travel. And I love when it gets down on that small scale. Mm-hmm. And also when she unruins Becca's wedding later. I also had a question about how Alma's hearing loss is portrayed, particularly in terms of her parents' very different reactions, because it's not until late in the season that we learn how happy Alma was at a school for the deaf, and that her father was the one who would have supported her staying there, but her mother kind of pressured her into getting a cochlear implant, seemed like she never learned ASL, and wanted to transition her to a traditional public school, which seems to be a major pivot point in Alma's development. But given what we later understand about Jacob's experiments on Alma to unlock her shaman abilities, I just wonder whether his position on her hearing is informed by his concern for her happiness, or is keeping her from getting the implant part of his wanting to like kind of exoticize her. I don't know if I'm reaching.
No, I think that's a good point. I actually have some problems with the way in which the show is not 100% clear on Jacob's motivations.
Yeah.
Because it feels like a lot of other stuff gets cleared up, like the facts of what happened that night and all of that gets cleared up. But we don't really get into like his psychological state that much, and in a show that seems very deeply obsessed with psychology and the inner workings of the mind, that feels out of step to me. But yeah, I mean, I'm as lost as you are on like, yeah, maybe he was worried about her and her well-being, and maybe he wanted to do more experiments on his deaf kid, you know. I don't know. I found that entire thing kind of half-baked. It felt like we put the hearing stuff to the side at a certain point to deal more with the mind and the schizophrenia and all that.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you about the Jacob's motivations and how we don't know what they are, but that, I mean, I feel like that might be explained by if he's kind of like a projection of her own psyche, that she can only, you know, she can't really know things. But then at the same time, she also, you know, she knows what happened the night of he was killed at the lab and stuff. Right. So I just wonder how much we're supposed to think she's just very intuitive versus whether she's like being shown things from the other side of the veil. Like, for example, when she's trying to talk her way into getting the records of what happened the night of the break-in from the security guard, who's voiced by Keiko Aguin. I love her. that she, you know, tells the whole story of this woman's life. And then Sam's like, did you get all that from her screensaver? So like there's moments like that where it's ambiguous about whether like she's actually seeing something or if she's just intuitive and good and a good detective, you know. I wonder if that's the case with the break in too.
Yeah, it just seems like a kind of big thing to guess, you know, like because her mother confirms that she was correct.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It feels like the show itself maybe isn't 100% sure which way it wanted to go. And, yeah. And I guess, spoiler, not spoiler, it never actually gets very definitive in that regard.
Yeah, yeah.
But does not close off either avenue either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't. I'm. It's funny, the more we're talking about it, the more I'm like, did I like this show this much? I think I enjoyed the experience of watching it more than I actually liked the content of it, if that makes any sense. It was an enjoyable watch. It was gorgeous in animation. It was well performed. I enjoyed the dialogue. And now that I'm sort of talking about it, it's like, there's a lot of holes here.
I'm going to guess that the fact that she was deaf and has an implant now isn't set dressing. It's not like, you know, well, she's a redhead and she's got a scar like that. I'm sure it's going to come up in season two or whatever. Like it is going to be something that has something to do with her abilities or, you know, her experience inside of having a foot in both worlds or something like that. Like I'm sure it's not there by mistake. We just don't know what it is yet. And sometimes they will reward you later on, like The Wire, you know, they'll just come back. It'll be a season and a half late. It'll be like, oh yeah, right. What did you guys think of the actual like rotoscoping? Cause I understand why they did, given that half the show takes place in this other world or this world between worlds or in people's minds, whatever it actually is, and doing traditional, you know, special effects on filmed content might not have the freedom to do what they want to do as much as they could in animated form where they just have to shoot the actors, they rotoscope them, and then they put them on whatever, you know, whatever world they want to. You know, kind of like how The Simpsons did that Homer goes on a Chili Bender episode where the animation's kind of slightly different, so you know it's not quite, you know, the world that they usually live in. But I have to say, at times, I felt like the rotoscoping got in the way of some of the emotional moments that they were trying to write. Like, generally, in rotoscoping, you lose some of the fidelity of what you film, right? And if you don't, I'm sure everybody knows what rotoscoping is, but basically, they film a scene and they trace it and turn it into animation. And nowadays, there's a whole bunch of computers and shit involved, but that's the general process. You know, you lose contour, you lose shading, you lose subtleties in the face. And there's a few scenes like with Alma and her sister or Alma with her boyfriend, Sam, where there was like this supposed to be this sweet or touching moment of dialogue, but like their pupils were bopping around in the wrong place and their eyeball and stuff. And it, like I was paying attention to that more just because, you know, as humans, we see that, you know, body language is very important, right? I mean, it's not something that we usually think of. It's just something we absorb. But when you have somebody's like pupil in the wrong part of their, you know, sclera, whatever it's called, it really like sends a weird signal. And like, I would often be like, wait a sec, what did they just say? Because it felt like they were about to have, you know, a possession moment where their eyes were going to go inside their socket or something like that. So I feel like, I understand why they did it, and the animation is very impressive and beautiful at times, but I thought once in a while that it got in the way of what they were trying to do in those scenes. And I'm wondering, like, maybe in season two, they'll learn their lesson, and on those scenes, they need to, like, zoom in more. Like, the closer they are to the face, the more you can tell all these little touches, right? Because when it's sort of like a medium shot and their head is like 1/16th of the volume of the screen, it's really hard to communicate these small little things. Whereas when it's a close-up, you get a much better picture of them after they rotoscope it.
Yeah, one of my notes was like, I'm not sure this has to be animated. And I do understand that the medium is part of the message here about the ambiguity of the reality of what we're seeing as well as what Alma is or is not seeing or experiencing. That's fine. But like we, you know, all went to university and I'm not sure that you have to continue with that particular underscore after after the first season. Like, I think you could go to live action because, again, I get it, but it might just be a showy reason for doing it versus, you know, how to best service the material. So,
yeah, I would agree that the closer up they get, the better they are. There were a couple of moments where when the figure is far from the camera, as it were, they have the kind of like flat appearance of like background characters on Frisky Dingo.
Yeah.
That will be for five people, two of whom are on this podcast, yeah. Three including me. But I also think that there were some shots that were very beautiful and justified it. And toward the end of the second episode, which we all agree should have been the end of the first episode, when Jacob is explaining, like, you can choose to go on this journey or not, and then or you can have a normal life. And as he's telling her, like, Alma's standing with these flowers that are like opening and closing, and it's like stuff like that where it's like, okay, I get it, you know.
Yeah.
Or when they're out in a meadow that looks like a painting, you know. There were times when I thought it was good.
Honestly, I think if they tried to translate those sort of scenes into real life, that would have seemed like some episode of Pushing Daisies or something like
totally.
That. Like, it wouldn't have been the same vibe. I think it would have sort of been a lesser show for it.
Yeah.
Right. Which is why I'm going to kind of stand up for the animation. I actually think it would not work as a live action series. I think that what you're talking about, Sarah, where the medium is the message, I think that's kind of cornerstone to all this. And I think if you were to try and do all of this through pure CGI, it would look really
fugazi. I could see that.
Straight up cheap, honestly. Like, you would have to like, for a budget for a show like this is not going to allow for like the most gorgeous CGI in the world.
No, it's going to be that I can't remember the name of it, that Robin Williams Annette Bening thing where he's trying to go to heaven and find her.
Oh God,
what dreams may come.
Yes.
Oh,
it'll be that. So I withdraw my statement. Listen to Kevin, everyone. He is smart.
I just really loved the actual style. Like, I thought it looked like a watercolor painting. I thought it was something I haven't really seen before. Because the only other sort of similarly styled thing I can think of is Richard Linklater's A Scanner Darkly, which was much more stylized, for lack of a better term. It looked much more like a comic book in real life, you know, and I didn't respond well to that at all. But here it felt a little bit looser, a little bit more dreamy, which fit with the tone of the series for me. So I was a fan of the animation. And I also think, thinking about season two, like, if it's going to continue to involve Raphael Bob Walkspark, it just feels like animation is part and parcel of that deal.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
He's an animation guy, you know?
Well, since everyone keeps talking about season two, I kind of felt like that was a perfect ending. I might not necessarily want more, but it sounds like Dave and Kevin, you're assuming that it will continue.
Oh, I'm not assuming. I'm saying, in the case that there is a season two, yeah. No, I don't think there will be a season two. They didn't give a season two to Forever. I don't know if they're going to give one to this.
Yeah. It just felt like a perfect open-ended ending for me. But Dave, you think the story could continue?
I just assume that if it gets watched enough, a second season will be made, because who is in the business of giving money to an enterprise that has to be this involved and this expensive just for 10 episodes? Like, Amazon is in the place where they want hits and they don't have many.
Yeah.
God, for God's sake, they gave Man in the High Castle 3 seasons. It deserved one, maybe, you know? So,
yeah.
This feels like it's a critical darling. It's actually got some emotional heft to it. I don't know if it's going to connect with people just because it is so different. But if it does and it gets numbers, for sure they're going to try to get a second season.
Yeah.
I'm always wrong about this. So, but I'm also always the person that said it should have stopped earlier than it did. So,
you know who the enemy is here, Tara? It's capitalism.
That's right.
Okay, everybody, it's time to go around the dial talking about what we're watching on TV these days. First up, Tara Ariano.
I was going to talk about the Lily Singh talk show, but I started to watch it today. No, I'm not going to. So read into that what you will. I did not like it. Season 9 is on the books. There's still of Married at First Sight. There's still a reunion to come, but we reached the finale, Decision Day. when the couples that the experts have matched announce whether they want to stay married. Since the U.S. version of the show premiered in 2014, experts, in giant air quotes, have matched 29 couples. I just want to ask everyone to guess how many of those are still married. Kevin, how many do you think they're still married out of 29?
Two.
How many did you say? Two?
Yeah.
Okay. Sarah?
Closest without going over. Price is Right rules.
There are no winners here. Just
okay, two and a half. Just kidding. I would have said two or three.
Okay. 29, I'm going to say five.
It's eight.
Okay. Wow. Just,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What the fuck is wrong with you people?
Yeah. I'm going to count the ones who just said in the finale last week that they were going to stay married, but by now could obviously be secretly legally separated by this point. I mean, it definitely happens a lot that people come to the reunion and say we're still married because they act like it's way after filming stopped, but apparently is actually like sometimes as little as 2 weeks. But anyway, so just under 28% have stayed married. By the way, I'm sure that's a better percentage than the entire Bachelor franchise, but that's not really a fair comparison. And in that the whole appeal of Married at First Sight is that these nitwits are not capable of choosing their own partners and therefore are letting these experts, which in this case means three people who have some kind of legitimate psychological or counseling credentials, to choose partners for them from a tiny pool of potential spouses. So given the incredibly shitty track record the so-called experts actually have, I mean, more than any of us thought, but still not great. I do think that increasingly people are just going on the show because they have long-term reasons for wanting to raise their profiles as, I'm not even going to say D-list celebrities, like P-list celebrities. Often it is that they're an MLM so they can flog on their Instagrams. This is true. You can look it up. Sometimes the experts do luck out and just match people where all of the conditions are perfect for relationship success. And having watched the show intently, these are the conditions that I think make for a good match. Both partners are actually sick of dating, which is distinct and different from thinking they're ready to settle down because they've, you know, reached some age milestone by which they thought they would have been married and they're not. That's number one. Number two, both partners are very basic such that they don't have any particular interests or convictions that they feel it very important to share with their spouse. And number three, not to be gender essentialist, even though the show is, obviously, these are all opposite sex marriages. It usually works if the woman is kind of bossy and the guy is a doormat. The last of these was definitely true of one of the season nine couples who stayed together, Greg and Deanna. They were very drama-free pretty much the whole way through. Wasn't surprised when they stayed married. It was a surprise when Jamie and Beth stayed together because they fought constantly. She's extremely annoying, and not just to him, like when they would go out with the other couples, like just really grating and awful. And Jamie left several times because he was sick of her shit. And my theory on them is that they had amazing hate sex. But the experts did wash out with the two marriages where they clearly cast for drama, thus ruining several lives. And again, I know I'm the only one who watches this show, so strap in. You're not going to believe this shit. First, there's Matt and Amber. Matt just retired from playing basketball professionally. He's overseas somewhere. Amber's a middle school teacher. Matt is almost like 7 feet tall, and Amber is 5 feet tall. So when they danced at their wedding, her head came up to his chest. They would go out holding hands. He looked like her daddy. Like, it was really fucked up. And I sincerely think the incongruity of how they looked as a couple physically is why they got cast. But the trouble is, he just got back from Europe or wherever he was. So when he got married, he was homeless. And the show gives new couples each a furnished apartment to live in during the 8 weeks of the experiment. So, you know, Amber's very cute. Matt, however, is hot. And it's rude to talk about people being in or out of whoever's league. But I guarantee from the way she acted that she has never dated anyone as attractive as Matt before. To wit, pretty early on, he like went out, didn't tell her where he was going. She tried to reach him. He turned off his phone. Like, she didn't know where he was for over a day because he never came home. Oh. So she called in sad to work because she was crying so much. No. This guy that she's met like 2 weeks ago, it was insane. One of the experts like tried to have an intervention, like come in the middle of the process and be like, do you think this is okay? But like, they're obviously not supposed to say you need to get out of here or we are going to take you out. So like, Amber was just like, I really wanted to work because she's stigmatized or whatever. Then they get to decision day. He clearly did not care. Like, she said first that she couldn't go on like this. And he was like, okay. And then they showed them back in their apartment, like cleaning up, and they had all of these Polaroids on the fridge. And she's like, well, do you want to take those? And he just like plucked them all off the fridge and like threw them in the trash. And the music is trying to be all sad about this, but like he does not care. Yeah.
Did he throw them in the trash or did he like do it from the 3-point line?
Yeah,
he gently dropped them in the trash. Okay. But anyway, if he was told when he was scouted in some bar that housing was included, we obviously know why he did it. Now, that was one couple.
Wait, before you go on, can I present a theory on why everybody is so sad and mad at this show all the time?
Sure.
On the show? If you had to spend 8 weeks in a furnished apartment, which I assume is like Oakwoods or something like that,
yeah.
You would never be truly happy.
It's true. It's depressing. Yeah.
We spent 2 weeks in an Oakwoods once and we almost dove off the balcony. Uh-huh. I don't know if you remember that.
I saw
scars.
Yeah. Drunk swimming guy. Yeah.
They're still in the same city where they live. So they like still have their apartments that they can go back to anytime, but they're living in this like, you know, short-term rental, whatever. That's a great point, Dave. Moving on. Then we have Iris and Keith. Iris is 27 and a virgin. And that is obviously why she got cast. Now, my theory on her is that when she was interviewed, she was like very coy about like, well, I'm a virgin, you know, technically, and gave it to, you know, let it be known that she did some stuff.
In a Mr. Parmook kind of way?
Sure. But that's not the case. She lied or like has a very different idea of what sexual maturity means from anyone else. She's super into being a virgin. It was like all she talked about at the wedding. Like when she was trying on wedding dresses beforehand, she kept saying like they weren't white enough. Like they had to be the whitest possible dresses so that everyone would know what it meant. Like, no, bitch, everyone wears white dresses. Like no one is going around with a Pantone card to see if you are like pure. She told
now I
Keith's,
want someone to do that.
She told Keith's mother at the wedding that she was a virgin. Her new mother-in-law. Like, ooh. No. And so then the experts are like trying to like bring them along in like very, you know, sixth grade levels of sexual touching. Like, here, look at these fun dice. You just throw the dice and then it's like, oh, blow boobs. And she's like, no, like not even that where it's obviously a joke. Like she just would not do anything. And so Keith finally is like, look, I want to have sex with my wife. Like, I'm not weird. I don't want to stay married to you. And so she also afterwards has claimed like the reason she was like this is because she just wanted to be modest on camera because she works with kids in some capacity. But like, don't go on the show then.
Also, kids are not watching this, I hope.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, afterwards, like Keith was so much nicer about her than Matt, like was still being respectful and was like, you know, well, I'm sorry it didn't work out and stuff. And she clearly was reading into it like he still wants to be together and like was giving talking head interviews where she was like, where she was saying things like, well, these are the kind of things that I would want Keith to work on if we got back together. It's like, you're not getting back together.
No.
Like, you're not.
She's sick of rubbing it out in the shower. You're done.
Seriously. It's not good for the environment. Anyway, the experts should all be stripped of their credentials and then stripped and marched through the streets with a lady ringing a bell and screaming shame. But that said, season 10 is coming soon in DC and I will watch it. Now, if you're interested in a show in which a psychological professional does not sully her profession, I recommend Couples Therapy on Showtime. I will not get into it here because I don't have to. I talked about it on the Appointment Television podcast, which is coming out this Thursday, September 19th. We'll have the link to the ATV podcast in the show notes. This is the podcast that's co-hosted by past guest Catherine Van Arendonk, as well as others. Sorry, Margaret Willison and Andrew. I don't know his name. He wasn't on it the day I was there. He's on paternity leave. Anyway. Check that out. Couples Therapy is on Showtime. They drop the whole season at once on the app. It is great. You should check it out and listen to me tell you why this week. Thank you.
Kevin.
So it's funny that you brought up a show in which people are put together by matchmakers, because my show is also a show about people put together by matchmakers.
Yeah.
It is MTV's Are You the One, which
yes.
just wrapped up its 8th season called Are You the One? Come One, Come All. Why Come One, Come
All?
Because season 8 was the first one cast with an entirely sexually fluid cast. What does that
yes.
mean? Well, that means nice. That everybody is somewhere on the bisexual side of the spectrum. They may be bi, they may be pan, they may be queer. They're somewhere in there. But basically, they're up for anybody in this group. So the way Are You the One usually works is that you have 10 cisgender men and 10 cisgender women, all straight. Before the start show begins, quote unquote matchmakers, which I assume means producers, put the 10 sets of people together into 10 couples, one man, one woman in each couple. Theoretically, you should be following your heart to try and date around, see who makes sense for you, fall in love. What you're really doing is playing the longest game of memory on record, where there can only be a certain amount of combinations. You have to figure out who your perfect match is, sit together, see if you can figure out who all 10 are. If you manage to figure out who all 10 couples are, the entire group splits $1 million or, you know, $667,000 after taxes or whatever. If you lose, no one gets any money. There's a couple different format things in here. You can figure out whether you're a match or not by going into the truth booth, which is as absurd as it sounds, involves lasers. you can sit together at a matchup ceremony at the end of the episode where they don't strictly tell you if you're a perfect match or not, but depending on how many perfect matches sat together, a certain number of beams of light or spotlights will shoot up into the air. So say there's 10 couples, 4 perfect matches, 4 beams of light, then you got to figure out, okay, who's who. So it's at the end of the day, a game of strategy. But of course, you get emotional people together who are drunk 95% of the time on this island. You're going to have people who act a little bit of a fool, you know? so that was taken up to 100 this season with the all queer season, because not only were there so many more possible combinations of people, because anyone in the 16 could have been with somebody else in the 16. It was over, I think, 2 million possible combinations of all 16, of all 8 matches. Oh my God. Was nuts. But also, queer people are often at different stages of their own process. So you have somebody like Basit, who uses they, them pronouns, is gender nonconforming, is very sure of who they are, compared to somebody like Max, who is effectively a farm boy who's just recently moved out to L.A., is only bi in L.A., basically not out to people back home. This show was his version of coming out, who's never been in a relationship with a man before. Max wound up being kind of one of the big stories of the season as he fell in love with his first guy, Justin. They were a fairly traditionally masculine-looking couple, very built, very muscular. They literally bonded over being bros at the gym before they decided to make out in the closet, which, progressive. together, they were known as Jacks. They were a major storyline this season. Everybody was rooting for them. Everybody was in love with them. You just knew that they were a perfect match. And spoiler, they were not a perfect match.
No!
The absolute heartbreak and devastation that happened after was merely one part of this beautiful, crazy, absurd show that often wouldn't even just be kept to the series itself and would often spill out onto social media, where the cast members were incredibly messy with each other. I described it in terms of the way RuPaul's Drag Race says, if you're not watching Untucked, you're only getting half the story. If you're not following the Are You the One season 8 cast on Twitter, you're only getting half the story. It was glorious. All episodes are available now. The season ended last week, the week of the 12th, or the 9th. They're all available on MTV. If you have a cable login, you can access. It's 12 episodes. I really think it's the show of the year in a lot of ways. not only because I think the format was craving something like this, where it made it more complex, where it made it more difficult to get through, but also what happens when you cast 16 queer people is that you no longer have to have queer people explaining to straight people different queer concepts. You know, that's one of my biggest criticisms of a lot of queer television, from Will and Grace, shout out Will and Grace and Kevin and Tara, to RuPaul's Drag Race in its modern era, to Queer Eye, the reboot. There's a lot of, because this is ultimately going to be primarily watched by a straight audience, straight viewers need to be explained concepts at all times. Kamala Harris is what I just said. Are You the One, Kamal is not really interested in explaining its concept. So as a result, you get queer people. There was one transmasculine gender nonconforming person, Kai. He was another sort of breakout character because he had a very tempestuous relationship with a queer girl named Jenna. In the very first episode, he asks her to come with her while he does his testosterone shots. Like, it's the kind of thing that you just don't see anywhere else on television. It's the kind of conversations you don't see anywhere else on television. And certainly for me as a queer viewer, it's people I don't see anywhere else on television, including, and I've sung the praises of RuPaul's Drag Race on this podcast before, not about that holiday special, but I I love that show. It's the thing I study the most of anything. But I think Are You the One really showed that there's a lack in some of these other programs that really could be solved, even if the matchmakers don't know what the hell they're doing. It has that in common with Married at First Sight.
That sounds amazing. Yes,
highly recommend it.
And for your plug.
Yes. So speaking of RuPaul's Drag Race, so I have been recapping the show since All Stars 2 aired, which was now, I guess, 3 years ago. But I've been watching it for forever. So one thing I really wanted to do in order to complete my historical record, as I call it, of every RuPaul's Drag Race season is to go back and re-review old seasons. It's actually been a really interesting project so far. I found that one season that I really loved was not quite what as good as I remembered it being, and one season that sort of has an overall negative reputation in the fandom I found deserved that negative reputation in the fandom. So it's been a little bit of confirming what we already know and revisiting other stuff. I'm doing it on Patreon. It's a project called Drag Race Rewind. We are currently in our third season. I'm doing season 3. And it's a subscription service. So for just $3, you get a recap of an old Drag Race episode in your inbox every week. The exciting thing is now that I'm doing season 3, original first 5 seasons of the show are now available on Amazon Prime, which is the first time that they've been available to watch as part of a streaming service, you know, package deal as opposed to renting them in a long time. So I'm really encouraging, if you're a Drag Race fan at all, if you haven't watched season 3 in a while, if you've never watched season 3 because you're a more modern fan, come on the journey with me. Throw in a couple bucks. I have had nothing but positive reception so far. So it's a fun ride.
Yay. We'll link it in the show notes.
Thank you.
Sarity Bunting.
Speaking of Are You the One, I'm here to talk about The Challenge, aka the show for which Are You the One seems to serve as a feeder instrument most of the time. Mm-hmm. I always think about starting to watch Are You the One, and then I'm like, they'll eventually show up on The Challenge. Why add to the DVR load? It's back as of last month. I think as you're listening to this, the fourth episode is going to air tonight. Good news, if you didn't realize, season 348, JK, almost, season 34, you didn't realize it was back, you can just jump right in. This current setup, which involves USA versus UK teams and this unbelievably baroquely complex, even for this show, tribunal setup and like team trade option plays after the elimination round. I mean, you shouldn't bother paying close attention until the herd is a little thinned out, but you almost can't. Like, it's just so, it's so Moebius strategery typical of the show that it's like, just wait until there's like 12 people instead of all the people. There's also plenty of other things to be annoyed by, as usual, including host TJ Lavin, like the beard plus one, immediately deducted that point because he's still calling the women competitors females, which that's not how we talk. Come on. Mm. The talking head interviews, which are not made more credible by repetition of how, quote, stacked the American team is. It isn't. Wes is on it. Please find another word. In the premiere, as all the teams are being ferried to the initial introduction scene, like the bleachers that they all stand on to hoot and holler and be steroidal, they're in like army trucks. And as the USA team is like being driven up this hill, Fortunate Son is playing. Like, the self-seriousness of the participants on this show is part of the love-hate appeal of it for me, but that's it's too far. Like, no, step away. I will give the show this, after all these years, the constant gameplay twists and antes up, the imports of contestants from as far afield as Survivor Turkey and Vanderpump Rules, succeed in keeping the show alive, and it's really not an easy thing to keep track of all the various alliances, rivalries, feuds, social media developments, and assimilate rookies into ongoing narratives that sometimes stretch back to like the Clinton presidency while still keeping the thing watchable for longtime viewers. Sometimes the concept of the season just doesn't go for whatever reason. Like it should be a barn burner, but then some key element gets eliminated in like week four and you're like, why are we still here? I think this might be one of those seasons based on who's already gone home. But if they're stacked up on your DVR, they were for me too. And like I said, I would just delete those and start fresh with episode four. Also, the episodes are really long, like they're hour and a halfers. This time, just like you could put it on the first fast forward speed and get everything you need. Speaking of getting everything you need, if what you need is every single Dennis Quaid project reviewed in chronological order, I'm on it. Quaid in Full has dropped. Episode one is live. Episode two on Kathleen Quinlan breakout vehicle, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, in which Dennis Quaid plays shark, comma, baseball player. That will hit Friday. And the most expensive Beretta DVD ever created is now on site at Quaid in Full HQ. So it's all happening. That's Quaid in Full Pod on Twitter, and subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
As I mentioned back when we talked about GLOW last month, I recapped the show for Vulture, and apparently it took some people a while to watch the show and or read recaps of it, because it was not until last week that I got a DM on Instagram from a representative of, I'll just say it, an acting legend. This assistant wanted to know how this legend could get hold of me, so I passed on my email address and today got a response, which I will read verbatim. Tara, huge thanks for that terrific shout out you gave me about playing Fluff Lecoq on GLOW. From your mouth to their ears. Love that show and love your writing. Cheers, Swoozy. That's right. Yeah. I got an email from Swoozy Kurtz.
Oh my God.
Someone who thought this would be a really funny prank to play on me. Like, I obviously have no way of knowing if this is really from her, but I'm going to believe that it is.
I mean, that's a pretty good con, but it's her. I believe it's her.
Yeah. So if you're thinking, wait, I don't remember Swoozy Kurtz in GLOW. She was not in GLOW. Fluff Lecoq was not a character that we saw actually on the show. But Sandy tells a story where she, because she's a former showgirl, where she refers to her old dance captain as being named Fluff Lecoq. And in my recap, I said, please, please, please let us meet this lady at some point this season. I am picturing Swoozy Kurtz. So, alas, doesn't seem like the show is going to stay in Vegas if there's a season four, which at this point we still don't even know if there's going to be one. But so I don't think Ms. Kurtz will ever get a chance to play this queen, but always nice to hear from a fan. Thank you, Swoozy Kurtz. Extra credit topic we're going to call a very blanky renovation. It comes from everybody at EHD Assist on Twitter, and they collectively, all of them, write, HGTV has a spare $3.5 million lying around. What TV exterior location should they buy next to renovate so the interior matches the show's sets? There's a chance that Dave picked the same one, but since I'm going to go first, I get to say the most about it. It's Fawlty Towers. The geography of that set makes so little sense as originally conceived that they had to have a whole episode after the pilot where they put in a door where one would logically be, like, that's the plot of the episode. When you get upstairs to where the guest rooms are, it's like a fucking MC Escher drawing. There's a staircase that goes nowhere that's completely confounding. Apparently, and when I looked it up, there's actually a Reddit thread about it, because that was specifically put in by the production designer who remembered a detail like that from like a weird inn that he stayed in Edinburgh. But anyway, someone actually has drafted the floor plans for both stories of the house. They are absolutely wild. So I would love to watch a renovation attempted on this structure, particularly since that I assume the plumbing foundation and roof of the actual structure of the building have not been updated ever. Kevin.
So I'm going to cheat a little bit. I did not go with an exterior, but I just went with a house that I would like renovated, because my beloved big brother has had the same house structure for so many years now. Mm-hmm. They will do like a fresh coat of paint on it basically every year, give it a new theme, all that.
Hose it down with Lysol.
Yeah, that. But that house's structure has not changed in so long. Head of household room is still upstairs. Diary room is still downstairs. Backyard, still the same shape. It is exactly the same thing every single season. And now that they're doing a couple different seasons a year because they've started doing Celebrity Big Brother, right, that house is occupied almost all of the time. So let's use that $3.5 million to give that house a real quick and really efficient makeover, knock it all down, bring it all back together, and make it just look somewhat different so I don't have to stare at the same goddamn house for one more summer.
Very nice. Sarah?
I was going to go with the Sopranos house in Belleville, but, yes, it needs to be renovated, but I have a feeling that they would, just renovate it back to that same blonde wood nightmare who wants to live there besides the Sopranos. So instead, I would like the back rooms of either the Bing or the Pork Store renovated. They both had these clubhousey sets where the guys hung out with Sinatra portraits and pool tables and whatnot. Or Tony Soprano's flashback / childhood home, but only in its flashback 60s mid-century incarnation and not when was living there and setting shit on fire on the stove and then Meadows having parties in it and having to clean up vomit. Let's go with the old flashback version with Livia in her rollers with a scarf over top.
Love Dave. It.
So first of all, last week I forgot to say thank you to HEG Assist for the help with game time. So this was me trying to make up a little bit for my mistake. So thank you, HEG Assist. So here's my idea. The network buys one of those massive airplane hangars, the ones that are so big, sometimes they get clouds forming inside of them. You build the tunnel from a working airport gate area to the far dark side of the hangar relative to the gates, the part you can't see. And then you bring people in it. As you emerge from the tunnel on the tarmac, you are in fact inside of a narrow Vegas mall style scene from a London alley. So you're not actually outside, right? When you went to the Aladdin and they have that mall and they
painted or the Venetian or whatever.
You're on the tarmac, but you're actually inside of a London alley set complete with fake sky. At the end of the alley, there's a telephone booth. It's an old booth painted dark blue with the words police box on it. And you're invited to step inside. You push open the kiosk door to discover the inside of this police box booth is impossibly massive and full of science fiction gigas. You have just exited from the alley into Doctor Who's TARDIS. And it's all full of Doctor Who stuff. You get to do all your Doctor Who things there. And at the end, where you exit through the gift shop, you can buy TARDIS-generated custard cream biscuits, which is apparently one of the powers of the TARDIS I learned today. It's Canon Time, presenting this week, Mr. Kevin O'Keefe. Take it away, Kevin.
Thank you. I am presenting The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Season 1, Episode 9, The Dinner Party from Hell. There's a rumor, maybe even an urban legend at this point, that Tina Fey starts all of her writers' rooms with one episode of The Real Housewives. She does this apparently because she considers it a masterclass in introducing characters, interspersing quotable dialogue and very funny dialogue quickly. That episode is, in fact, The Dinner Party from Hell. Whether or not that rumor is true, you can see why she would choose this episode. After a hostile trip to New York City for the Housewives of Beverly Hills, one that resulted in an utter blowout of a fight between Kelsey Grammer's then-wife Camille and Halloween child star Kyle Richards, Camille decides to reunite everyone for a dinner party. With remarkably strong cocktail served, seriously, they look, as Lisa Vanderpump calls them, like soup, a chef on hand to make pizza, and the inspiration for the show Medium, Alison Dubois, on hand as a special guest, what could go wrong? Clip one.
I just gotta make sure she's gonna get drunk.
This episode is a personal favorite of mine and many a Housewives fans, largely because of Alison Dubois and her e-cigarette. But there's a lot to recommend this episode beyond just the medium with a mission. This is a prime example of the ways in which Real Housewives is not just a reality show, but an elaborate chess match masquerading as a light lifestyle fair. First, it takes the Housewives tradition of a dinner party to the extreme. There are several social staples on Real Housewives shows, from game night to the group trip abroad. But it's the dinner party that is maybe the most entrenched tradition. It's inherently not a neutral space, as one woman hosts while inviting all of her friends and even some nemeses to join her for a meal. In this case, Camille Grammer was the outsider at this point. Her claim that Kyle Richards had dissed her, implying the only reason the show would ever want to shoot with Camille is if Kelsey were there, had caused a major rift on the trip to New York. And Kyle infamously declared, "You're such a fucking liar, Camille," which in normal friend groups would basically mean that Kyle is not invited not only to this party, but any dinner party going forward. But this is not a normal friend group. The Real Housewives is not a normal setting, and this party is not just a party. It's a battleground for social dominance. Camille invites Kyle not to make amends, but to get even. She wants to rattle Kyle to get her upset and in the process prove herself to be the bigger person. Because in this group, only one woman can sit on the queen's throne, or so Camille believes. She weaponizes the dinner party against her enemy, and a crucial part of that plan rests with the medium herself, Alison Dubois. Clip 2.
We're not supposed to be good. We're supposed to be really, really bad in a controlled setting.
She's a lunatic. this episode introduces not just Alison Dubois, but also Kyle's friend who she brings to the party, Faye Resnick. If Alison was the only featured player in the Dinner Party from Hell ensemble, she would be more than enough, trust me. But this episode is too kind to us, and as Kyle brings along Faye. Faye, as played after this episode aired on the People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story by none other than Connie Britton, was an odd side character in the Simpson trial. She was a friend of Nicole Brown Simpson's, but leveraged that connection to publish a rather salacious book full of damaging information about her late pal. She's one of Kyle's closest friends, which says a lot about Kyle's taste in friends, but this was her first appearance on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. She would go on to later be a major recurring character in season 3 and make appearances throughout the entire series. Kyle mentions she's bringing a friend to the party when Camille invites her in a rather uncomfortable phone call, but she doesn't say who the friend is going to be. That it's Faye, someone so controversial and, as we find out, strong-minded, is an aggressive play out of the gate by Kyle. All of a sudden, Camille is no longer the host with the famous friend. Kyle's brought a friend, too. It's here that we see why Camille got her reputation as such a conniving player of the Housewives game in her first season. She seeks to undermine Faye by bringing up her sordid past in clip 3.
You know how I know her? I saw her naked in Playboy. That's how I know Faye.
It's noted by fellow cast member Kim Richards, sister to Kyle, that Camille's sudden recollection of how she knows Faye is utter nonsense. This is a calculated counterattack by Camille, and she makes clear in her following iconic confessional, clip 4.
I recognize during the dinner, it was the hair. I think it's the extensions and the blown up fake lips. But, and then I realized, oh my God, that's who it is. It's Faye Resnick. The morally corrupt Faye Resnick.
Morally corrupt Faye Resnick. If this is where the party ended, we'd know this is the Camille versus Faye fight, right? We'd know it is. The morally corrupt Faye Resnick would probably even be the episode title. Camille would have walked out the winner, having successfully secured the dominant narrative and the best quote of the episode. And that almost was the end of the episode. At this point, as the story goes, producers were sure they had enough of what they needed from this event and were actually taking down their cameras and lights. They even take off Allison's mic, as you can hear in the episode. But Kyle, either not able to leave well enough alone or perhaps realizing that she needed more, decided to prod Alison Dubois for a reading. Camille discouraged it, but Kyle and her friend, Lisa Vanderpump, wouldn't stop provoking Allison. So, read she did in clip 5.
Have you been married twice?
No.
Oh. Well, then that's the last one you have. I guess that's good news. I was thinking she was going to have to get married again, which meaning you'd have a divorce.
If my husband ever leaves me, I'm going with him.
He will never emotionally fulfill you, ever. Know that. As soon as the kids are bigger, you'll have nothing in common.
Just a side note, I have a poster in my room that says he will never emotionally fulfill you on top of not Alison Dubois smoking. Real Housewives shows are inherently about social warfare. It's true, but it's cold warfare. Such a brazen shot across the bow at someone else's marriage to the incredibly hot Mauricio, by the way, is sort of outside the rules of engagement. Allison was a loose cannon, which even Camille seemingly notices at this point. The moment also played ironically as by this point in the real life timeline, aka what's happening while the show is airing as opposed to when it's filmed, Camille and Kelsey had announced that they were getting divorced. Combined with her noting that Kyle doesn't get along well with women, which was very untrue, but very true of Camille, there's reason to believe Allison, if she's truly the medium she claims, might have actually been reading Camille instead. But I digress. The gauntlet was thrown, and with decorum broken open, Kyle and Camille used their chance to hash out their very real issues, which is another thing I really love about this episode, is that it actually moves the plot of the season forward. Ultimately, the dinner party from hell is about the New York City trip that had happened a couple episodes prior. As Lisa Vanderpump says, upon Camille bringing up New York, she says, "Oh no, not New York." Camille rehashes her feelings about what Kyle said, which Kyle continues to deny entirely. Kyle also takes issue with Camille's self-presentation during the fight in New York in clip 6.
Of course, because Camille, you sat there the entire night like this. You know, with your hand there like that.
But that's who I am.
No, that's not who you are, Camille. That's who you are pretending to be.
This fight was ultimately more about subtext than anything else. As was revealed in that season's reunion, Kyle believed Camille was performing a character throughout the season, with the discomfort of losing her husband, something she wanted to mask. Sure enough, the next season, Camille completely rehabilitated her character, earning the title Saint Camille from fans for her newer, kinder character. The years since have called into question exactly which version of Camille is the real one, as a hearty defense of Brett Kavanaugh and a pattern of lying earned her much scorn from the other women and from fans in the most recent season. Kyle even called her worse than, quote, season one Camille, as we see here. Many Real Housewives episodes are guilty of not actually adding anything to the season story-wise. The women will go to an exercise class and maybe talk about some recent fight that happened, but no one actually pushes anything forward. Conversely, some of the most incredible event episodes of Housewives, I'm thinking particularly of Scary Island from The Real Housewives of New York City Season 3, are so disconnected from the plot of season entirely that they act as their own self-contained arcs. The dinner party from hell has its cake and eats it too. The Alison Dubois fight is a separate event altogether with no connection to what happened before or what happens after. But the Kyle and Camille fight is core to the main plot of this season. That this episode is both instrumental to the story and fully absurd on its own merits is something of a feat. Finally, it has what I feel like every great episode of reality TV needs, which is just an unforgettable frenzy at the climax. Had the dinner party from hell walked out of our out of the doors of our lives with "He will never emotionally fulfill you" and the morally corrupt Faye Resnick, we would have all been well satiated. But the dinner party from hell wasn't done giving us gifts. Like many a great episode of not just Housewives, but reality television as a whole, it ends in a messy melee chock full of great lines. First, Faye and Allison square off in a battle of the friends of the Housewives in clip 7.
You are.
I am so bored of this conversation.
Then
honestly,
leave.
I'm totally over
then
it.
Then leave. If you're over it, then leave.
Allison, you leave.
You walk. You've got two legs. The last time we checked.
Ooh.
Then, amid the storm and Kyle and Camille already interlocked in the drama, Kim Richards decides to bring up her previous conflict with fellow cast member Taylor Armstrong. It leads to three fights happening at once, with Kim pulling a great line out of the mess in clip 8.
Okay, enough, girls.
Why don't you
enough,
blow up
enough,
your lips
enough,
some more?
Enough! Enough, we're enough. Crazy. We're not doing this anymore. Yeah. I'm not having this anymore. Enough. Yeah. Get up. These are not the ladies that we are. Enough.
After Taylor quells the situation, and it's clear there will be no winners tonight, all the other housewives take their leave. Camille is left with an empty dining table, save her friend Dee Dee, and the smoking medium in clip 9.
My dad said, live life large and make no apologies for who you are. F*** them. I don't give a shit what she thinks Allison. About me. She can fuck off. I can tell you when she will die and what will happen to her family. I love that about me.
Allison and Camille ended their friendship after this episode aired, very sadly. But I can't help but pray that she finds her way back on reality TV one day. Still, that this is the only dose we ever get of her is all the more reason to recommend The Dinner Party from Hell. It is one of the most tremendous one-episode performances from a reality TV figure in the genre's history. The Dinner Party from Hell is the definitive episode of the Real Housewives franchise. It's a surface-level pleasure, hearing a character as surreal as Alison Dubois drop absurd quotables between sips of her oversized cocktail and drags from her e-cig, but it also gets into the psychological games these women play with each other, using other friends as pawns in a social war for power. I am proud to present it in consideration for the canon as a massive Housewives fan, and I hope that you'll find it worthy of inclusion.
Oh my God, Kevin. Wow. Should I go first?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, first of all, I just want to, I'm glad that Dave provided some Doctor Who content, because I know that every time we talk about a lowbrow show in the canon, people get mad about, like, you didn't induct War of the Schnorglax when I submitted it, blah, blah, whatever. The point of the canon is to appreciate a show in terms of what it is trying to do, and as Kevin has beautifully laid out, this is clearly, I mean, I can say without having seen it, you know, almost any other episode of the show, clearly this is the platonic ideal of what you're trying to do in a Housewives show. And like, sure, you could say there's like a lot of filler up leading up to the actual party, and like some of it is fine, whatever. But the payoff is so great. I mean, I know that Camille is a garbage person, but every time they cut to her, like, looking secretly gleeful that she started all this shit, it's like, oh my God, that's me watching this episode. Like, it's so relatable. Allison is such an insane monster. Saying that she's the best one character, one episode person in reality history, like, clearly that is true. I almost feel bad for Dee Dee, the other friend that's just there for, like, ballast, who does nothing. But just sit there and be scandalized. But like, there's just so many, there's so many phases. There's so many moments, like Camille being like, and who is Faye, when Faye is sitting at the table? Like, and what is your story? Faye might be the more slightly polite way to do it, until you've, and then you realize, oh no, Camille is just setting herself up to be a bitch. Like that she's feeding herself her own line. And then you find out that Camille was also in Playboy. So it's like,
but she had a bikini on, and everyone's like, asshole says what?
Yeah, seriously. Like, even Lisa is like, what's the point? Like, it's true. Yeah, this was a joy. Like, it's amazing. I couldn't, the best part of it, I think, is that I couldn't pick anyone's side to be on, because they're clearly, like, just all should fall into a volcano. Like, it's, but watching them go through it and just imagining the producers on set being like, holy shit, we have struck such gold with this nonsense. And even taking into account like how much more sanitized I assume it is now, that everyone is so much more polished and has such a better sense of like how mm-hmm. they come off on the show versus like this being the first season of it. No one was really that experienced. Obviously, they must have had some idea of like what they were performing, but still, it feels more raw than later episodes that I've seen of like other episodes of the franchise. Yeah, this was a joy. There's nothing else to say. Oh, one more thing. When they're all outside, like in their little knots, you know, trying to debrief and like assure each other in whatever clumps they're in that they were right. And then the sprinklers come on. It's like,
yes,
chef's kiss. How yes. do you top that? I mean, whatever PA was inside turning them on, God bless. And I hope you got a promotion. So Kevin, I loved it. And I loved reliving it in your presentation. Thank you so much, Sarah.
I also love this. I do think it's important to understand that in a, you know, when something's being considered for the canon, you're assessing it for like, what is it setting out to do and how good is it at doing that? This is outstanding. I'm not sure the prostitution whore table flip crown can be taken, but I'm one of those people who only watches New Jersey and also watched Miami. So, my opinion is worth nothing. My notes contain some variation on or synonym for I am very uncomfortable like 88 times. This is sort of an interesting thing, because like certainly on Real Housewives of New Jersey by this point, the trip and then the big dinner party are like, one is the dinner party is sets off the fight for the first half of the season. And then the trip sets up the conflicts for the next season, despite the fact that a whole bunch of shit is like happening on social media as we speak, or like someone was sent to prison. The timelines are a mess. But I think Jersey is much more cynical, I guess, especially at this point, about how they're fairly open about what's going on. And sometimes someone in a talking head will just be like, all right, well, here's the, you know, we're going to go to this costume party and I'm going to get in a fight with X, dot, dot, dot. What is not said is because a producer suggested that I do so, mm-hmm. so they can continue getting screen time. Like, we all know what's going on here.
Yeah.
But there is a craft to it, even when you can see the seams of it, that I respect on the production side. But in this case, like, there did seem to be some genuine animus, and it wasn't like, because as Tara said, it is early in the show's run and it is a little more raw seeming, but emotionally also, like, there was the sincerity to the fighting and to the drunkenness, certainly. No one was acting that shit, that you could, like, enjoyable is not the right word, but the way that that whole thing is constructed and where the talking heads are put in the middle, like in the middle of this, what Kevin called a melee, there's a talking head with Lisa Vanderpump who's like, I find Camille difficult to read, which was like one of the gentlest expressions of, I think she's probably a bitch, but I can neither confirm nor deny, and there is not a dog in the room with me to ask. I was just like, I just had to pause it, and I was like, queen. I mean, yeah, look, whether you enjoy what the Real Housewives franchises are trying to do, like, that's not required. But I think looking at this episode, you have to acknowledge that what they set out to do, they do really well. And that there is a architectural craft to building it. But also that this was like a little more sincere and intense than most of these like climactic dinner/trip fights. And then Faye fucking Resnick is there, and a medium. And oh my God, I mean, and the Richards is like, oh God, it's amazing. I might have to start watching this franchise. Anyway, excellent submission. I really enjoyed this, and I watched it with my new dog, who is part Pomeranian and who was interested in what was on screen, especially at Lisa's house. All right, Dave, take us home.
All right. Well, first of all, Tara, the Book of Glaglornox or whatever that was up top is a perfectly fine series. I don't know why you're bagging on it. Everybody loves it.
People are going to start sending you candy now.
When we did the last one, which I just looked up while everybody was talking, which was the Housewives of New York, and they're all at the Christmas party somewhere up in
Berkshire County.
Yes, yep. That one. Yeah. Oh, God. I'll just recap what I said there, which is I hate this show. But I appreciated what they were doing in that episode, and I appreciated if you are in to watching divas being terrible people, I understood why you would like that episode. I believe I also said, watching the episode, you could really appreciate the hand of the story editors creating mm-hmm. that story, because
yeah,
you could tell exactly. When things were cut, when things were switched around, when reactions for one thing were stitched on to another. It wasn't truthful, but it made for compelling television. I only want to do one of those, guys. I don't want to keep on saying I appreciate what they do, because I mean, they're all the same. I mean, it's just bitches being bitches. And I understand that this was less of a story editor craft, that it was just like lightning in a bottle where all this shit just happened at one party. And I'm sure there's stuff at the beginning, the end, and you know, they coax people in the talking head segments to say things that would nicely bumper two scenes together and stuff like that. But I feel like I'm, for this one, if I said yes, I'm not really saying like the craft is good. I'm just saying like, as far as jerkasses being jerkasses, boy, these jerkasses sure were jerkasses. And that's like not really what I'm here for the canon for. Certainly, this is one of those totally not for me shows. And I really tried my best the first time to figure out a way to explain that I appreciate the craft of it. And this one just seems more like a celebration of diva culture, and I'm not really in it for that.
I think we could allow you to abstain in this case.
I'm not going to abstain. The one person I think that does come out of this good, because you're saying at the start, like, you don't know who to root for. Who's the Jane Seymour one?
That's Lisa Vanderpump.
Like, she was fine. Like she said all the right things. She, like, kept out of the melee while still being kind of catty. Like, the thing about... you know, when you're at a party, like, everybody's a doctor, you know, like what's this on my neck? So if you have a medium there, you have to ask them, what's the future entail? That is sort of true. I mean, if you go to a dinner party with a whole bunch of people you don't know, you have to perform, or at least talk about your job or something like that. You just can't play dumb and say, this is my night off. So,
or just give a fake reading that's it. Like, I see something with a J and a body of water. It's not that fucking hard. And then you can get on with your night.
Yeah. Although after watching the episode, I'm wondering if they have, and if not, why they haven't had Patricia Arquette. Is that who she played in? Recreate that scene. Like, that should be like a Funny or Die thing or something like that.
Don't quote me on this, but I think they might have done that on Watch What Happens Live. Oh, there we go. Sounds amazing. Familiar to me.
That absolutely sounds believable.
Yeah, I would totally buy that. All right. So I've said my piece, not for me. Really, if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to check out season 3, episode 2 of The Book of Gleiglor Knox. It was a real surprising episode. Let's put this to the vote. Tara Ariano, what say you?
I realize what I really want is like someone to just create me a syllabus of the most essential episodes of the Housewives franchise that save me having to like watch all the boring ones. But
you know, I will do that. You know, I will do that in an instant.
This was a joy. I mean, Dave knows there's nothing I love more than watching strangers fight. And that's all this was. So obviously this was great as far as I was concerned. Yeah. So it's a yay for me.
Okay. That is very true about Tara Ariano. Sarah Day Bunting, how are you going to vote?
It was really important for me to reunite this with the canon. So yes.
Yeah. As usual, my opinion doesn't matter.
Oh.
Real Housewives Beverly Hills Season 1, Episode 9, The Dinner Party from Hell. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Canon.
Americans, the winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Okay, it's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has this week's winner.
Not that he needed any help from us, but it's Norman Lear, who becomes the oldest Emmy winner ever for the live All in the Family and the Jeffersons special. Couldn't have happened to an older guy. It didn't.
Thanks for keeping it short, Sarah. This is going to be a journey. With all due non-respect to Felicity Huffman, repeat visitor to the loser section of this podcast, just sentenced to serve 14 days for her part in the college admissions scandal. Our loser of the week is, in fact, Shane Gillis, but also secondarily SNL. Here's why.
Yeah.
Last Thursday, Saturday Night Live announced the hiring of three new cast members, one of whom was a dude named Shane Gillis. The Shane Gillis news was immediately followed by reports of his history of having done things like defend Louis C.K. and make racist Asian jokes on a podcast. This was especially bad timing since it happened the same day the show hired Bowen Yang, a writer on the show who is also now its first ever Asian cast member and who is also only its second openly gay cast member.
Yikes.
Yeah. So Gillis tweeted a shitty apology the day the bad news broke, which was, I'm a comedian who pushes boundaries. I sometimes miss. If you go through my 10 years of comedy, most of it bad, you're going to find a lot of bad misses. I'm happy to apologize to anyone who's actually offended by anything I've said. My intention is never to hurt anyone, but I am trying to be the best comedian I can be, and sometimes that requires risks. This is so tone deaf and bad and dumb and wrong. Ugh. Anyway, SNL dithered about it for a while, but then announced yesterday, as we're recording this Monday, that Gillis had been fired, and he had another shitty statement already, which is, It feels ridiculous for comedians to be making serious public. I added the B. His did not have that. To be making serious public statements, but here we are. I'm a comedian who was funny enough to get SNL. That can't be taken away. Of course, I wanted an opportunity to prove myself at SNL, but I understand it would be too much of a distraction. I respect the decision they made. I'm honestly grateful for the opportunity. I was always a mad TV guy anyway. Attempted self-deprecation.
Fuck off.
I can't source this. I saw an anonymous report on Twitter, but allegedly the show had asked Gillis to make a more sincere apology, and when he wouldn't, they fired him. And that, if that's true, would explain why it took so long. But part of the problem with this shit only coming out when people can point to content from podcasts is that, unlike a Twitter feed, podcasts aren't searchable for content yet. And I will also add, I just read an item today about Roseanne setting off on a comedy tour with Andrew Dice Clay. So if they need an opener, I assume they found him. So congratulations to him for his career serving the most aggressive, dumbest comedy audiences ever. TM at Kath Barbadoro on Twitter, who I just stole that insight from, but she is right.
I just don't understand how, like, the internet served up this footage in like 12 minutes.
Oh yeah, it was super fast, for sure.
Where the fuck, SNL, were you?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of the mind that this was not accidental on SNL's part.
Really?
So here's my thing. Like, yeah, we are in an era where SNL has gotten increasingly queer, increasingly good with its female cast, which has always been a problem. Like, on its face, it's a pretty progressive era. So why are Colin Jost and Michael Che still the faces of Weekend Update after all of the shit? Yeah. I think SNL kind of wants to have its cake and eat it too. Like, I think this is the same thought process that led Donald Trump to be a host in 2015, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think there's some level to it's like, we're apolitical, which means we need to represent all sensible sides of the aisle, quote unquote. Like, Colin Jost isn't out here voting for Republicans that we know of, but like, he's espousing very centrist, sort of anti-left views, right?
Right.
And Michael Che's a monster. Sorry, he is. He's the worst.
Don't be. I agree.
So I'm of the mind that, like, okay, you're hiring Bowen Yang, a gay Asian man, and you're hiring Chloe Fineman, who is wonderful. If you've not looked up her Instagram, I highly recommend doing so.
To have said her name in that whole litany. She also got hurt in this because all of the attention went to this doughy idiot with no lips.
Right. And it's such a shame because she's so fucking talented. She has more impressions than you'd ever imagine. If I'm Lorne Michaels, and like, this is sort of my modus operandi, is like, all right, let's find somewhere in the middle. Like, who do you get to counteract Chloe and Bowen? It would kind of look like saying Shane Gillis, you know, Gaines Gillis. Sorry. I'm not of the mind. Maybe NBC didn't know,
right?
But I'd be shocked if somebody in the vetting process hadn't found this.
Oh, okay. So your conspiracy theory is not they didn't find it. No. Your conspiracy theory is that they knew about who he was and they hired him anyway.
To be a conservative comedian.
Yeah. Mine would have been they knew this and they pretended to hire him anyway, knowing that there would be a firestorm, and then they could try to look like they were woke by giving him the boot immediately. Mm-hmm.
If it was more immediate, I think I would agree with you. But the fact that it took days.
On the other hand, NBC, shit moves slow.
Yeah, true.
Speaking about sneaking away during this segment because you really had to pee because you drank too much during the original start of the podcast, do you know what time it is?
Pee time?
Yeah, sure. This is the eighth game time of the season. The scores are Tara 4, Sarah 2, Value Guess 1. With a win today, Tara could clinch the season. Today we are playing What's the Difference from Kimberly, who earns herself an extra credit topic. Contestants must guess the difference in years of various elements in the show, and these elements will change round to round. In a rare format change, everyone will get to play each question because we'll be playing by popular consumer product pricing game show rules, where The closest without going over will win the point.
I foreshadowed that earlier.
You did. If anybody happens to guess straight up the correct answer, you will get double the points for that. So you'll get 2 points. Because of the nature of the game, we won't be using steel meals this week. We'll be skipping the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zones for time. The playing order, of course, is going to be a little different, too, because of the importance of guessing last. So what we'll do is we'll establish the order for question one with Picky in a moment. And then after that, each question starts with the person who won the last question.
Okay.
So please remember who you always play after, so I don't have to keep on prompting you. So with that, let's throw it to Picky to see our order.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Our order is Tara, Sarah, Kevin. Are we ready to play What's the Difference?
Yes.
Yes.
Here we go. Round one, characters versus actors. How many years difference are there between the actor's age and the age of the character they are portraying? All measurements taken as of the pilot episode.
Okay. Got it.
So I'm going to give you the character and the show. If you really need it, you can ask for the actor. I'll give it that for you free, but I'm not going to read it unless you need it.
Sure.
You must take the character age. You must take the actor age and give me the number that you think is the difference. And we're going to go Tara, Sarah, Kevin, starting with Tara's bid.
Okay.
The character, Dylan McKay. The show, Beverly Hills 90210.
5 years.
5 years. Sarah?
6 years.
Kevin?
I'm kind of handicapped, so I'll go low. 1 year.
The correct answer was 8, so Sarah gets the point.
Sarah!
Question number 2. Starting with Sarah. The character, Andrea Zuckerman, also from Beverly Hills 90210.
As of the pilot. 12.
Yeah, I'll go 10.
1.
Sarah is within 2. Correct answer, 14 years.
Oh,
character
shit.
Was 15 years. She was 29.
Jesus.
All right, we're going to wrap up our 90210 questions with Steve Sanders, played by Ian Ziering, of course. Steve Sanders.
Ian Ziering.
Yes.
10.
8.
1.
And Sarah sweeps 90210. One off. Character age 15, actual age 26, difference 11.
This is why you read all of the actors' bios.
Yep.
All right. So moving into other shows. Jon Snow from Game of Thrones.
This is me again, right?
Yep.
Okay. I fuck if I know. 5.
2.
6.
Correct answer was 7. Tara gets the point. Was supposed to be 17, was 24.
Okay.
Xander Harris from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Starting with Tara.
7.
4.
1.
Tara takes that 7 was the closest to the correct answer of 10. Was supposed to be 15 in the pilot. In fact, was 25.
Oh, shit. All right.
All right. Going to start with Tara again for Betty Suarez from Ugly Betty.
2.
3.
4.
22 was the character. 22 was the actor. 0 difference. Y'all went over. No points. Lila Garrity from Friday Night Lights.
Oh.
So am I still starting?
Yes. We'll just carry
on. Okay. 3.
7.
4.
Sarah was the closest with 7, was supposed to be 15, played by a 26-year-old Minka Kelly.
Yikes.
All right, moving on. Cookie Lion from Empire, played by Taraji P. Henson.
2.
4.
10.
Sarah was within one. Correct answer was 3. She was 44 when she portrayed a 47-year-old on Empire. Next question. Sarah will start us off. Arthur Fonzarelli from Happy Days.
It was Happy Days.
No, it went all Happy Days.
15.
15.
16.
16.
8.
Tara gets it. She said 8. Correct answer was 9. Character was supposed to be 19.
Really? That's it?
Oh. He was 28.
I thought it was more dramatic.
Lisa Simpson. I guess this is excluding the Tracy Ullman thing.
I see. From the series.
Yes.
Not counting the shorts. Right. Okay. She's supposed to be 8. Let's say 25.
30.
Now, remember, Kevin, I'm not 26. Saying this because it's germane to this question one way or the other, but I just want to remind you of the value of lowballing everybody once in a while as the last person. That's your advantage. There's always something to keep in mind as the last person.
Yeah, but I don't think it's under 25. Fuck it. 1.
You are the closest without going over, Kevin. 17 years the difference between Lisa, the 8-year-old, and Yardley Smith, the 25-year-old.
She was young.
That shocks me.
Yeah. All right. Brendan Small from Home Movies, played by Brendan Small.
Oh, it's me. Yep. 4.
20.
Hmm. 21.
All right, Kevin, you guessed so far away from the answer, but everybody else went over. The answer is 16. The character was played by the creator of the show, who was 24 at the time.
I have no idea what that show is, so that was a shot in the dark.
Well done. Doesn't matter.
Here is a related question of sorts. Louise Belcher from Bob's Burgers.
Mm. 20.
15.
22.
Sarah takes it 1 year off with her guess of 22. It was 23. Nice. 9 and 32 were our ages. And that is it for round one. So let's hear the scores, Tara.
Okay. Kevin has 2. I have 3. Sarah is well ahead with 6.
All right. Can they catch up with Sarah? Let's find out. In round 2, parents and children. How many years difference is there between the ages of the actors playing a parent and their child? Again, all measurements taken as of the pilot episode.
Okay.
Sarah is going first, having clinched the last question in round 1. Livia and Tony Soprano of The Sopranos. take the parent's age, you take the child's age, you tell me what you think the difference is as actors.
With the actors. 20.
20 from Sarah to Kevin.
16.
I'm going to say 30.
Tara is closest without going over. The answer is 33. 33.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Nancy Marchand, is that how you say it, was 70. And James Gandolfini was 37. I can't believe he was 37 at the beginning of that show. Oh, my God. That is crazy.
Rough 37.
Yeah. That's a lot of life lived. Okay. Tara will go first for our next question. Martin and Fraser Crane.
Okay. He was pretty old. I'm going to say 30 again.
30.
20.
20.
21.
All went over. John Mahoney, 53. Kelsey Grammer, 38 for a difference of 15
years. He was 38?
Yeah, speaking of rough.
Yeah, oof.
Shirley and Keith Partridge of the Partridge family?
23. 19. 1.
Kevin takes it with a low ball. Last person won. The answer was 16. 20 and 36.
20. And that was his real life stepmother.
Yeah.
Donna and Eleanor Shellstrop from The Good Place.
Oh, man.
It's nothing. It's like... God, it's like... One.
I guess I have to say two.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to say three.
Oh, boy. That's the way you do it. Sarah will take that because the correct answer, in fact, was 8 between Leslie Grossman and Kristen Bell.
Oh, really?
That's way bigger than I would have assumed.
44 and 36.
Hmm.
All right, this is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
We are looking for the difference of the actors who played Lydia Herrera and Penelope Alvarez from One Day at a Time, 2017 edition.
Hmm. 35. 40.
I think they're really far apart, but I'm going to just say 41.
41 is our first dead on answer.
Nice.
85 and 44 between Rita and Justina. So Tara, give yourself 2 points for that one.
Okay.
And you will go first guessing for Vladimir Dracula, Count of Transylvania.
Sure.
Blue.
And Lily Munster. Why is Munster coming up so much in these games times? Has anybody on the board actually seen one episode of the Munsters in their life?
I have not.
I have.
Okay.
I have.
No. I didn't enjoy it, but I did it.
Once again, Vladimir Dracula and Lily Munster.
I don't know, 20 years.
20 years.
One.
Two.
You all went over. The answer, -1. The parent was 41. The child was 42. Al Lewis.
Jesus.
And Yvonne DiCarlo.
Oh, my God.
All right, guys, this is question. We are talking Eugene and Katie Gatling from A Little Show. Is it Benson? Yes, it is Benson. That's Janes Noble and Missy Gold.
Yeah, God. 40.
James Noble. 32.
33.
Tara takes it. She's the closest. Difference, 57 versus 9, 48 years. 48.
Mm. Wow. So you never know, because he was gray, but like people looked older then.
Yeah.
It was all that fluoride in the water.
Ah.
Fred and Lamont Sanford from Sanford and Son.
Oh, I don't know, like 10.
22.
I'll split the difference, 11.
Sarah takes it. 24 years was the answer. Red Fox, 49. And the other guy whose name I don't have here, something Wilson, right? 25.
Lamont?
Something like that.
No. Yeah, I don't know.
The internet will provide us the answer in due time. All right, moving
it's
on.
True.
Good job, Sarah.
Thanks.
Philip and Kimberly Drummond from anybody?
Different Strokes.
Thank you. That's Conrad Bain and Dana Plato.
Conrad
R.I.P.
Beige. 35.
To Kevin.
37.
40.
Tara is closest. The correct answer, 42. Conrad Bain, damn. 55. Dana, 13.
Hmm.
I'm not quite sure which pronunciation we want at the end of this. Henry and Frank Regan or Reagan from Blue Bloods.
Reagan. She says authoritatively.
All right. Henry Reagan and Frank Reagan from the show Blue Bloods. Blue Bloods.
I know who Frank is. Can you tell me who plays Henry?
We have Len Carreo and Tom Selleck.
Oh, it's his dad. Oh, okay. Len Carreo.
Lev Curry.
I bet they're closer than we think. I'm going to say 16.
12.
I'll go one.
And Kevin is closest.
Kevin.
70 versus 65. The difference, only 5 years.
Wow. Oh.
5 years. Ruth and Nate Fisher. Numb. On. Narm. That's 6 feet under.
Oh.
Frances Conroy, Peter Krause.
Wait, who is she?
Frances Conroy, she of many American horror stories and whatnot.
No, no, no. I know her very well. I your audio cut out.
Oh, Ruth and Nate Fisher
Balenciaga.
Are our characters.
Yes. No, I'm very well aware of
I know
six,
you.
It's 6 feet under. It's on HBO, on television.
Bye. Give me 15.
15.
I'm going to say 22.
22.
Took mine. One.
Sarah was correct. One is the closest answer. She's not correct. She's just closest. 12 years. 47 versus 35 at the time of the pilot.
Sure.
Here comes our last question of round two. Sophia Petrillo and Dorothy Zbornak of Sarah. The Golden Girls.
Actors, not characters.
That's correct. So Estelle Getty and B. Arthur, of course.
Negative two.
Negative two.
I think it's like negative five.
Negative five.
Oh, boy. I'm gonna say zero. I'm going to say they're the same age.
Tara, with the answer of zero, went over the correct answer, negative one. So Sarah was closest with negative two.
Sarah.
62 and 63.
Dang. Yeah.
All right, that is round two. So Tara, let's return to the scoreboard.
Okay, Kevin has 4. I have 8. Sarah's still in the lead with 10.
All right, we have enough questions that we do not know our winner yet. So let's get back into it with round three. Round three is our historical round. Oh, how many years difference between the year in which the pilot takes place and the year in which the pilot aired?
Oh, okay.
So the setting of the show versus the year we first started watching it. And I'm going to give you the pilot year, okay? So really, you just need to know when it was set and figure out the difference, okay?
Okay.
Yep, got it.
Our first show is Deadwood, which premiered 2004. So what's the difference in years between its airing and its setting at the start of the series?
I start, yeah?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. 130.
I'll say 115.
One.
Oh, just one? That wasn't
yeah.
Okay. Kevin takes it. Sarah, you were 2 off. The answer was 128 years.
Oh, damn.
Deadwood starts in 1876. That was a heartbreaker. That was a heartbreaker. But Kevin takes that point. Our next show, Agent Carter, that debuted 2015. Agent Carter, 2015. What's the difference between when it aired and when it was set?
I want to be really careful not to overshoot this. 63
from Kevin.
Wait, oh shit, never mind.
You can change it.
Okay, I meant 73, sorry.
73 for Kevin.
Okay. 69, nice.
70.
69, nice. Correct answer, 2 points.
Right.
Oh, is that true?
Nice. Yep.
Shit. Thanks, 69.
1946. Nice.
Right.
Okay, this is my issue. I couldn't remember if it started before or after
the war.
Yeah. All right. Get out your calculators. The show is Rome.
Yeah.
It debuted 2005.
Okay.
Now, if you know your history and you know what took place near the start of Rome, you can get really close to the ballpark.
I don't, so I'm going to say 2,100 years.
2,200 years.
What year did you say it started? 2005?
Yeah, 2005.
Eight.
Okay.
And starred Francis Conroy and Peter Krause.
Bye. I will say this. I have actually never watched 6 Feet Under. It's one of the ones I want to watch the
really?
Most.
You'd
yeah,
like
my
it.
Parents didn't want me to watch it when I was like still in high school. It's one of the few things that they like sort of put a hard limit on of like.
Really?
Yeah. I don't 100% know why. Huh. Like I watched Sopranos. Like
yeah. Oh, well. It's not more objectionable than Sopranos.
Like, yeah. Violent stuff. I think I might have been the gay shit thinking about it now.
years. So we got 2100, 2200, and 2201 years.
History club over here.
History club is disbanded. You're all over.
Oh, no.
2005 versus 49 BC gives us 2054 years.
Bah.
A few years before Caesar is murdered. I'm pretty sure that's 44 BC. So
okay.
That's a ballpark. All right. Little House on the Prairie, guys. Little House on the Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
Kimberly, let us know if you got this right on during your listening of Game Time. It debuted 1974. What's the difference between 1974 and the year the pilot was set in?
Oh, God. I know. Well, I won't go through my process. I'm going to say 99 years.
99 years from Tara?
90 even.
90. And Kevin?
100.
100 is the correct answer for
wow,
2 points.
Wow, nice.
1874 is our year. Well done, Kevin.
Well done.
Everything's coming out, Kevin.
Our next show, Firefly, which debuted in 2002.
Fuck. Kevin, we agree.
Fuck off.
2002 Firefly.
It's... So do I have to do negatives because it's
no,
in the
no,
future?
No, no, it's just a okay. difference. It's just a difference. It's okay. Fine. You just give me the difference.
I legitimately have no idea. 500.
500 from Kevin?
800.
800 from Tara?
One.
One. Kevin is the closest. Only 15 years off. 2002 wow. It aired. 2517 it took place. 515 years the difference.
Dang.
Nicely done, Kevin. Kevin.
Total guess.
All right, guys. This is one you might be able to actually math it out. Downton Abbey started in 2010. What is the difference right. between 2010 and the year the pilot was set in?
102.
I'm trying to do the math. I'm too stupid to be my own handwriting. 2000.
Do you want to break it, take a break for dinner?
96.
98.
98 is exactly correct.
Sarah.
Sarah Bunting got it.
Yeah, well.
Miss Sarah Bunting.
Miss Sarah Bunting. What on earth is she doing here?
All right, that's enough of that.
Has Miss Bunting gone?
All right, here we go.
Not yet. Sorry.
Back to it. The show The Americans. It debuted 2013. Looking for the difference between 2013 and when the show was set as of episode one.
32.
You said 2013?
2013.
33? Didn't stand a chance after Sarah said 32 right at the start, because that is the correct answer.
Nailed it!
1981. That's when the Americans start.
Yikes.
Okay, guys. I know we were all big fans of the show Rain, which debuted in 2013.
Uh-huh.
What is the difference between that year and the year it was set in? Rain.
Rain.
Yeah,
Rain.
Regan. Yes, sorry.
Yes, the Free People costumes in old-timey Scotland show on the CW.
Oh, right. I have to start. What was the premiere year again, Dave?
2013.
400.
400 from Sarah. Kevin says?
I just have no concept of the historical, like, when the thing took place.
I bet dollars to donuts the show didn't either, so probably not.
Fair. 350.
$375.
Sarah DeBunting is the closest. It was 456 years. It took place in 1557.
Okay. Interesting. All
right, got four questions left, so let's get a little score update, please, Tara Ariano.
Okay. Kevin has 8 points. I have 10 points. Sarah has 15.
Oh, wow. All right. I guess if a lot of people get twos and Sarah biffs it, we could have something, but...
It can happen.
Yeah.
No, don't say that.
Let's
Everybody
find out.
Can win points on every question, so anything is possible. Let's see where it goes. Our next show is MASH. It debuted in 1972.
Okay. So, 1972. 21.
Kevin?
I think that's over. 15.
I was going to say 15, so I'll say 16.
Boo.
Sarah D. Bunting getting more points. The correct answer, 22. 22.
Oh, wow.
Okay. The show, Vikings. The year it debuted, 2013.
Fuck.
Bad. 1700.
I like that guess.
Okay.
This is as good as I'll come up with. Let's say 1800.
Okay.
You should.
1700, 1800?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember from the little bits of what I saw. Like, are people wearing shoes? Jewelry? Like, I sincerely don't remember.
Is there a wheel? I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, I don't know. 1300.
13. Oh, Tara. If you're going to go lower than everybody else, you're supposed to go to one. Don't you know how to play this game? You went over.
No.
Everybody went over.
Oh.
Dang.
793 for a difference of 1,220 years.
Bah.
All right, let's go to our next show, which is in our historical round, The Jetsons.
Sure.
It debuted 1962. The difference between 1962 and the year it was set. How many years difference are we talking about?
555.
555 years, says Sarah D. Bunting. Kevin O'Keefe?
500 even.
500 even. And Tara?
I mean, I guess I'm supposed to say one.
You're supposed to say whatever you want, whatever's
okay,
in your
one.
Heart. Tara takes it. The correct answer, set... 100 years exactly from its debut, 2062.
See, I was going to say 75, and I would have still won.
Here comes our last question of regulation game time. Yes. The show, Penny Dreadful, it debuted 2014.
114.
Sorry, 114?
Yes.
Okay.
One.
Interesting.
Two.
Tara got the closest. It is 123 years. It took place in 1891.
Okay.
All right, let's hear the final scores, please, Tara.
Okay, Kevin finished with 8. I had 12. Sarah is our victor with 16.
Holy cow, dominating this game. All right, congratulations, Sarah.
Thank you.
We'll make it official in a moment, but let's do our tiebreaker for a steel meal in use next week. In the pilot episode of Outlander, the lead character Claire travels back in time how many years? So, don't shout it out. We're going to go in order of how Celtic your last name sounds to me. So first is Kevin, then Sarah.
Fuck you.
Then Tara.
I've never watched Outlander. 50? I don't know.
50?
Sarah's got to be next.
Yeah.
Yes. It is a Welsh name. 300.
300?
I feel like I know. Shit. 250.
250. Sorry, once again, 50, and then what did Sarah say?
300.
300
and 250. See, Kevin, this is why you went first, because you are totally correct.
Hey!
It's exactly 50?
No, you're the closest. Oh. Tara was probably the closest, but over 203 years was her difference between 1946 when she disappeared and 1743 when she appeared back in time. So Kevin O'Keefe, the most Scottish person we know, wins a steel meal for the value guests. But Sarah takes the day.
Sarah.
Thank you.
All right, guys. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We went back and forth on the rotoscoped elastic reality mental illness romp undone before going around the dial with stops at Married at First Sight, Are You the One? And The Challenge. We celebrated Tara's tiny triumph, constructed new ideas for other Brady-esque renovation shows before Kevin deconstructed the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills dinner party from hell for its successful induction into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
the morally corrupt Faye Resnick,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I'm seeing the letter C,
and Kevin O'Keefe,
I know when every single one of you will die, and I love that about me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
You know what? I hate to say it, but we're having a girls' night, so I'm off the clock.